This edition of Culture with Robert Bound was first broadcast on the 27th of August 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to the 46th edition of Culture with me, Robert Bound, a show where, this week, random rules. You'll see why when I say what's in it. Here we go. First up, Culture producer Katie Bilboa sets her jet for the UK's second city, Birmingham, to experience a day of Stockhausen's seven-day opera, complete with helicopters.
A string quartet in helicopters flying simultaneously 11 orchestral musicians independently while they play their musical instruments, managing an octophonic stereo space in relation to two separate choirs. The challenges are very big, but exciting.
We'll hear from the filmmaker who's made a moving movie about Spanish Olympians moving fast. That's Paralympic cycling, of course.
When you see Juanjo going around the banked circuit, you can't help but think, how the hell does he manage to stay on, you know? It's almost like he's glued to the bicycle. And they're going fast. I mean, I couldn't keep up with him. With my two legs and two arms, I could not keep up with him.
And we'll head to New York's coolest beach, where artists and ordinaries put their well-honed bucket and spade skills to the ultimate test, the Rockaway Beach Sandcastle Competition.
You don't know about this? You don't know nothing about no sandcastles.
Plus, we'll have a quite sexy live session and interview with the jazzy Helene Giselle, and we'll hear the latest on the struggle between old masters and the shock of the new in Berlin. That's all here on Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Song time first, of course. Helene Giselle's a young British jazz singer with a neat line in interpreting the Great American Songbook, which has recently been informing her writing of a debut album of original compositions. From that, we got this Midori House session. This is Girl in London.
Haven't changed the bed in over a week. I left your cup lying dirty in the sink. And I stop. I don't wanna cry again. Trying to recall how dark those eyes are. Dying to forget the day they left. So I dream. And I know I shouldn't die. It's just your girl in London calling. I know I said I wouldn't, but I've been climbing up the walls, thinking about you. It's just your girl in London. You say you've been through all this before, telling me you'd leave if you had a choice. So nice to have it all. Well, I can't help the way I'm feeling. I can't box it up so easy like you. So effortlessly do. Or did you know I wake up every morning, reach across, but you're not there. I can't stop drinking you away. And as I wash off all the makeup, I see a ghost instead of me. Oh, I need to hear your voice again. It's just your girl in London calling. I know I said I wouldn't, but I've been climbing up the walls, thinking about you. Could I have loved you better? Maybe. Would you have really left her for me? It's just your girl in London thinking about you. It's just your girl in London. I wanna know, do you think about it? The night we pushed the limit and broke every rule we made. It's just your girl in London calling.
And that was Helena Giselle performing Girl in London for us here live at Midori House last week. In the world of 20th century classical composers, it's safe to say that German artist Karlheinz Stockhausen was a bit of a standout. Bordering the line between genius and insanity, Stockhausen's experimentation with electronic sounds and almost total rejection of classical and operatic established norms earned him influence and controversy in equal measure. He spent 25 years of his later life composing a seven-day opera titled Light, the 7 days of the week. Hugely ambitious, often mad, and technically extremely complex, the work is divided into 7 days, each of which is a 4 to 6 hour spectacular in itself. Arguably the most famous of these, Mittwoch aus Licht, or Wednesday into Light, contains a helicopter string quartet. This is, yes, a string quartet playing in 4 helicopters while flying through the air. While the quartet has been accomplished on a handful of occasions, the production has never been staged in full because of the spiralling costs involved. So when culture producer Katie Bilboa heard that its world premiere as a full performance was taking place in the industrial heartland of England's West Midlands, she had to jump on the train to see and hear for herself.
This is no ordinary opera, but then this was no ordinary composer.
One of the great figures of the 20th century, one of the great composers of the 20th century, one of the great innovators of the 20th century. He took it further than anyone else. He did more things in more directions than any other composer probably in history. This is the kind of thing that everyone should love because it's strange, it's experimental.
A few among us are not terrestrials, and that music that I am allowed to make makes this contact with the beings who can listen and who can make the contact with these vibrations that come from other worlds.
2, 1, fire!
Karlheinz Stockhausen's Mittwoch aus Licht, one of the great epics of this visionary and often beguiling composer, has never been staged in full. Part opera, part theatre, part impenetrable sonic experiment. It requires an extremely open mind and a total suspension of disbelief. Even then, you might come away with no idea about what's just happened. It's the Wednesday part of a 7-day opera, a work which took him 25 years to complete, as he spiralled into an increasingly spiritual and some argue cultish phase towards the end of his life.
It was classic Stockhausen, just completely undercut the whole avant-garde scene. You know, he started to do a 7-day, massively religious opera based on 3 very religious characters, Lucifer, Michael, who's a sort of Christ-like figure, and who some people think is him, he thought was him, and Eve. This couldn't get any more religious, and for the avant-garde, this was obscene, really.
Igor Toranilalic is classical music editor for the Arts Desk website. He's a fan of this experimental composer who also made his way into popular culture, appearing on the Beatles' Sgt. Pepper's infamous album cover in 1967.
It is one of the strange things, paradoxical things, because as well as creating this quite complicated music, he was one of the most popular composers. By the 1970s, he was Deutsche Grammophon's most widely sold 20th century composer after Stravinsky. That's huge, and it kind of baffles us now. Maybe we've become more conservative since then, but these works are tricky, they're not easy, but they are sort of, they are otherworldly, and I think maybe back then people were up for otherworldly music more than they are now, and he was incredibly popular.
Igor has travelled up from London here to Birmingham, England's second city, to an old warehouse in the industrial east end of town. It's an area which has been transformed in recent years and now hosts a thriving art scene. Outside, a noticeably white and middle-aged crowd of excitable, spectacle-wearing Stockhausen enthusiasts are milling around. Some are admiring the camels. Yes, camels. Well, this is Stockhausen we're talking about.
We've got Vanetta, who is an 11-year-old brown female Bactrian camel, and then we've got Kazakh, who is a 4-year-old white Russian Bactrian camel.
And how
unusual is it for camels to be involved in something like this?
Well, I think anything to do with Stockhausen is unusual anyway, and I think it's quite normal for camels to be here, actually.
Inside, a world premiere is about to take place. Powered by funding from the Cultural Olympiad, the cultural sister of the Olympic Games, the Birmingham Opera Company will be performing Mittwoch aus Licht, all six parts, in full. It's the first time anyone has had enough money to bring the whole thing together, and is a huge logistical challenge, as artistic director Graham Vick explains.
A string quartet in helicopters flying simultaneously 11 orchestral musicians independently while they play their musical instruments, managing an octophonic stereo space in relation to two separate choirs. The challenges are very big, but exciting.
Vick seems an appropriate match for this Stockhausen premiere. He's one of Britain's leading opera directors and recognised around the world. Igor again.
Well, if anyone can do this, it's Graham Vick. I mean, Graham Vick is one of the kind of innovative geniuses of opera. He's also famous for introducing the community into operas, providing an immersive experience, not allowing a separation between audience and work to occur. And this work suits that sort of philosophy perfectly. It is famous for having some ludicrous moments, and whether Graham Vick can pull them off, we'll see. One shouldn't really consider this as an opera. I think what it's more like is a sort of life ritual, a religious ritual, something where the audience is an active member of. And I imagine Graham Vick will have all sorts of interesting things to say and do with the audience.
Inside the huge warehouse, the epic begins. The audience squats on small camping stools around the huge central mixing desk in total darkness. As the electronic soundscape unfolds, corners of the vast concrete warehouse are illuminated sporadically to reveal a series of rather odd scenes. Balloons float up from open cardboard boxes. Pregnant women march in a pack to a halt. Agile dancers scale the walls like nimble lizards. Next, we move rooms to another lofty and barren but brightly lit space. This is the World Parliament sequence. While we sit on the floor on foam cushions, a choir of suited diplomats arrive. Each has their face painted with the flag of a different nation. They nest themselves on raised yellow seats atop small ladders which line the edges of the space. We're surrounded. The choir debate, argue, discuss. At times discordant but often unified, there's eventually a consensus. It's surprisingly engaging and accessible. After a short break, we're in the same space, but this time lying on the floor. Above us are solo instrumentalists who've been suspended from the ceiling on glass seats of varying sizes and heights. Each takes their turn to woo the crowd, channeling the scenes which are acted out around us. An airport by the sea. A kindergarten with small goats. Wild geese over a railway station. All strict instructions from Stockhausen's score. There's a queue of open umbrellas. Yes, it's beginning to get a bit odd. We all know what's coming next. The Helicopter String Quartet. Making the connection between a string quartet and the sound of a helicopter may seem obvious to some, but this is pure Stockhausen territory, as Igor explains.
Stockhausen was one of the first to fully figure out a language, a system, a form where you could incorporate ordinary sounds, the sounds of people splashing about in water, of goats, of children, of helicopters, and incorporate them with the pitched sounds of orchestral instruments.
We're seated back on the stools around the mixing desk. The tension is mounting. Could this all go horribly wrong? Does anyone actually know what's going on? We watch the musicians on individual screens in four corners of the space, As the helicopters rise into the air and start moving around, their passengers deep in concentration. None of the four can hear each other, yet technically it's a success. I'm struck by the drama of it, the surprising harmony within the chaos, the relief when it's over. Then it really does get a bit nutty. The show ends with a large camel fighting with and sitting on a trombonist. The camel is unzipped to reveal a man inside who turns out to be a presidential figure, dispatching the surrounding subjects into the universe. It's as if Stockhausen wanted to confuse everyone. As we sip on drinks in the farewell room, John, who played Palestine in the World Parliament, reflects on being part of the performance.
It's very, very different. Most of the time you can't really use your voice because it has to be a sound rather than a note a lot of the time. Quite hard work, and a lot of detail has to go into it because Katinka, who's the music director, was very, very strict on everything in the score had to be done exactly as it was on the page.
Because she worked with Stockhausen for 25 years,
yeah,
is that right?
Yes. She has been described as his muse, I think, some people have said. But yes, they worked very close together for quite a while.
For Igor, overall, it's been a success.
It was crazy by the end. The last hour was crazy. Like being inside the head of Tom Cruise or something, you know? We're talking Scientological madness, you know? But it began so brilliantly, very clearly. There's just so much going on. Really, most of it was pretty brilliant. But of course, you know, as with any sort of mad genius, as Stockhausen clearly was, there, you know, you've got to take the rough with the smooth. And there was a bit of rough. but there was a lot of smooth. There was a lot of stuff that was fascinating. There's no coherence, really, to the whole thing. It's fragmentary, but I kind of love that. It's sort of, again, it kind of fits in with this idea of it not being really a sort of opera in the classic sense of like a drama with a story, but more of a kind of a weird religious ritual that involves all sorts of strange elements, some of which don't make much sense, and it all just being almost just life, just this very strange world life that you're engaging in.
Graham Vick hopes that the performance, which was streamed online, will open up opera to a new audience.
I hope they'll love opera. I hope they'll be profoundly moved and thrilled by the music, by the theatre. I hope they'll go away realising that Stockhausen is the genius he is, the great entertainer that he is, and that opera is a limitless, beautiful art form that anybody can enjoy.
It's hard to know whether this performance will result in a renewed interest in the composer's work. I, for one, can see why this is a man who commanded both cult-like commitment and disdainful criticism. But the response from this audience to one man's unrelenting creative vision couldn't be clearer. For Monocle, in Birmingham, I'm Katie Bilboa.
For those just joining us, you're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound, where now we're moving from a German artist of one kind to an art institution in the nation's capital. Home to six centuries of European paintings, the Gemäldegalerie in Berlin's Potsdamer Platz region is the quintessential collection of old masters, housing works by Albrecht Dürer, Hans Holbein, Jan van Eyck, Raphael, Titian, Caravaggio and Rembrandt. Recent plans, however, to relocate the paintings to make room for an expanding collection of 20th century art has sparked an international campaign to keep the paintings where they hang. Reporter Melanie Sevchenko visited the Gemäldegalerie to find out more.
It's the only systematic and encyclopedic picture collection in Germany. It's comparable to, let us say, London National Gallery, Washington National Gallery. I think it's even more systematic than the collection of paintings in the Louvre.
Professor Bernd Lindemann is the director of Berlin's Gemäldegalerie. Opened in 1830, the German collection is one of the finest and most comprehensive in the world, whose early Netherlandish and Italian collections are considered particularly exceptional.
I have the impression that a lot of people are very interested on old master art. The problem is that we have no money for any marketing, for any advertising for the museums. And then all these 250,000 visitors who come into the Gemäldegalerie know exactly what they want. And they study the paintings. They do not just run around as in the Louvre. So I always say the quality of the visit is very high. And that's, for me, that's more important than the quantity of the visits.
The paintings that survived the Second World War were divided between the Kaiser Friedrich Museum, later known as the Bode Museum, in the east of Berlin, and the Dahle Museum in the west. In 1998, the Gemäldegalerie was relocated to the Kulturforum Museum District, west of Potsdamer Platz, and today can be viewed as an undivided whole.
If you will try to divide the Louvre in several places, it's a little bit funny, isn't it? But it's special in Berlin because there has been the wall and all these political difficult situations. So they don't know what richness here is, and they are not proud on that.
Gute Zukala Redlefsen is a Berlin-based art historian who specializes in medieval art. She's leading an organized protest with petitions and letter writing, together with art historian Jeffrey Hamburger of Harvard, against the recent controversy to move the old masters from their current home to a more centralized location. Ever since the reunification of Germany, it's been the hope of Professor Lindemann and his colleagues to move the collection back east, onto Museum Island in Berlin's central Mitte district. Museum Island is a complex of five internationally significant museums that occupy the island's northern part. The space of the Gemäldegalerie will then be filled with a collection of modern surrealist art from German collectors Ulla and Heiner Piesch, who preside over works by Dali, Rothko, Magritte, Frida Kahlo, and Jackson Pollock. The Piesch collection will be combined with the expansion of the 20th century collection of the new National Gallery, located across the street.
And when you go in there, you realize that it's a beautiful building, but it's much too small for the collection of 20th century art. So they need more space, and they can fill the building of the Gemäldegalerie. And this was our idea, to go with the paintings, the old master paintings, back to the island, and then the National Gallery will use this building for their own purpose. Our problems in the museums is not only an issue of the Piesch collection, it's a problem of the 20th century collection as a whole.
The move would require the building of a new wing onto the Bode Museum on Museum Island to house the 3,000 old masters of the Gemäldegalerie. The Bode Museum is largely a collection of sculptures and late antique and Byzantine art. It's a project to which the federal government of Germany has offered 10 million euros.
We try to understand what is going on in the planning of the Gemäldegalerie, and we were very astonished to hear that this kind of new installation was initiated. It was a hard work to show all these pictures in the Gemäldegalerie. People worked for more than 20 years on this, and now they have to do it once again.
Worries have already been circulating that the Gemäldegalerie receives less visitors compared to other museums in the capital, with fewer than 300,000 each year. The fear of the critics is that the old masters of the Gemäldegalerie will end up in storage for years before a new space is prepared on Museum Island. Sitting outside the Gemäldegalerie, museum patrons Heiner and his wife Barbara are enjoying an afternoon break with a small picnic.
I find this gallery one of the most beautiful of Europe, and one can compare it with the Uffizien, with Prado, and all the time they are lamenting that there are not enough people coming in. And therefore, they wanted to put it on the island of the museums. I think it's wonderful that it is not overcrowded, like Uffizien. And I find it is a scandal to put it for 10 years in a magazine. I think it's a damage for the city, for Berlin.
But Lindemann says that won't happen.
Because the communication was rather bad, people have the impression that we will hide most of the paintings for years, and others say even for generations. But be sure that we will do anything to avoid that.
Cyril, a French businessman living in China, says that after visiting the Gemälde Gallery, he's convinced contemporary art would suit the building much better than the old masters.
I mean, it's as close to an urban disaster as you can get, so I guess surrealistic art would fit quite well in the area.
The Gemälde Gallery is in serious need of a suitable environment that is deserving of the masters. The oldest items in the museum are the precious altar panels dating from the late Middle Ages. The collection also holds examples of all the schools and styles of European paintings from this period to the conclusion of the Baroque tradition towards the end of the 18th century. Lindemann explains.
Formerly, these museums were royal museums of Prussia, then stately museums of Prussia, but since 1947, the state of Prussia doesn't exist. And, well, then, in the western part of Germany, people had a problem. There were items, there were objects, there were works of art, but there were no owner because the state had gone. The only solution which was able to be made was to create this foundation of Prussian heritage.
As it stands today, building plans for the new wing on Museum Island are yet to be scheduled. For the time being, the old masters are safe at the Gemälde Gallery, while Gute and her colleagues continue their efforts to keep them in public view.
We need more publicity for all that. It's a shame because this collection is famous. It's very famous.
For Monocle in Berlin, I'm Melanie Savchenko.
You're listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. We're back with a filmmaker who's been following some amazing Paralympians after this.
Marseille, renowned for its multicultural makeup and hard edges, is a city being reshaped. To discover the beating heart of Marseille, Monocle Films visits three hoteliers who reflect the evolution of this heady Mediterranean city: Au Vieux Panier, Le Petit Nice, and Hotel Le Corbusier.
I always used to say that we are here to share our passion. Here we are so proud of the building, so emotionally attached to the work of Le Corbusier that we are proud of it and we want to share it.
Marseille in Motion, Monocle Films on monocle.com.
Welcome back to Culture with me, Robert Bounds, on Monocle 24. Part of the challenge in documentary filmmaking is the search for engaging characters. The next stage is convincing these people that turning their lives into a film is a good idea. The tiny Barcelona and London-based production company Black Train Films have done just that. The team have been following a group of disabled cyclists from a Barcelona club which trains in the velodrome built for the 1992 Olympics. Their next stop is the London 2012 Paralympic Games, which begin this week. The documentary, Los Imparables, The Unstoppables, is still being filmed but has already received huge interest worldwide for its inspiring characters and uplifting and often candid approach to disability. The team are now seeking the funding to make it into a full feature-length film. Culture producer Katie Bilbao was so intrigued by what she'd seen of the work so far, she invited exec producer Richard Galvani into Midori House to find out more.
We're following two Paralympic cyclists, one amazing guy called Juanjo, who has just one arm and one leg as a result of a motorcycle accident. He's competed twice already in the Olympics, in Beijing and in Athens, and he got two silvers. He's now 48, probably be his last Olympics, and he's really hoping to get a gold. And the other person who's our main, the other main protagonist, is a lady called Raquel. She lost a leg in a motorbike accident, and she's hoping to get her first medal. So it's a very exciting moment.
And how did you come across these people? How did you end up wanting to make this film?
I've made three documentaries up until now, all based on music and jazz. And my two passions in life are music and sport. And when we finished the last one, I was going to call it a day. But the young director on the last documentary said, what should we do now? And I said, well, I'd really love to make an inspirational documentary about people with disabilities overcoming problems and achieving wonderful things. And I think the reason for that came from hearing about all the soldiers that are coming back from Afghanistan. Unfortunately, we hear about the ones that have died, but there are dozens or hundreds that have come back without limbs. And I just feel that the way we people look at disabled people is needs a bit of change.
Let's go back to these two protagonists, because Juanjo, I mean, I've seen some clips of it. I mean, he is just inspiring, isn't he? I mean, he's so unstoppably positive is what struck me about him. And you say it's likely to be his last Olympics, but they've said that to him before, haven't they? That he's got to, yes. He's got to his peak, you're not going to get any better. And then he's beaten his own personal best and carried on to win more and more medals and championships and things.
He's truly inspiring and a wonderful guy to be around. I think we all wake up some days with aches and pains and itches and things, but as one person says in the documentary, and some of the comments we've had on Facebook, remind me when I'm feeling sorry for myself about this guy with one leg and one arm. You know, the first day we filmed him, I didn't really know how to react to him, and he cracked me up, caught me straight away, because he said, make sure you get a full body shot. So, and that's the way he is all the time, laughing and joking and pushing himself to the limits.
Yo siempre así va y vaya a guanyar. Me agrada es guanyar. Y em vaig desmaiar sobre de la moto. I em van donar clínicament mort, que estava, però em van ressuscitar i aquí estem.
And Juanjo is kind of the leader of the group. They call themselves the Pirate Club, do they?
Yes, they've got a team name and a nickname. I think it's because they say they're fearless, you know. And his motto is, if I have to die, let it be riding. So he's got the Pirates team tattooed on his leg.
Do these cyclists use prosthetic limbs just for normal kind of everyday life on a day-to-day basis?
If they're cycling for sort of everyday travel, so to speak, then they will probably have their prosthetic leg on. And but if they're taking part in the competition and training to qualify as a Paralympian or para-athlete, then they have to take that off, take the leg or the arm off.
So they can, and they're not allowed to compete with prosthetic limbs.
That's correct. But when you see Juanjo going around the banked circuit, you can't help but think, how the hell does he manage to stay on? You know, what is it? And it's almost like he's glued to the bicycle. And they're going fast. I mean, I couldn't keep up with him with my two legs and two arms. I could not keep up with him.
No, they're incredibly fast, aren't they? Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask about the kind of relationship that you've formed with them during this period. Are there difficult times when there are things you can't say or things you can't do or difficult moments? Or how has it kind of evolved as part of the filmmaking process, the way that you've interacted with these athletes?
I think the problem probably lies with me rather than with them, so to speak. You know, you do wonder if you should react differently to a normal-bodied person, but of course that's crazy. You shouldn't. They treat us, or me, as a normal, us when I'm referring to the film crew, as normal people, which I hope we are. And, you know, so then you realise you want to put your arm around the guy and you get the wrong side, so to speak. It doesn't matter. To me, it's all part of re-education, the way we think and we look at people with disabilities. And I think there's got to be a seismic shift in education and the way that people look at somebody with a disability. You know, this is what we want to portray, that if you do have some sort of unfortunate accident or disability, physical or mental.
One of my favourite moments that I've seen so far is where Raquel goes out on a race and you see a shot from her handlebars, I think, and it's her going around the track, and then you cut to something else and then you come back and you're on the handlebars again, but you can hear her breathing and you can hear the effort she's putting into it, and you can hear that she's really going for it, and she's, you know, really out of breath. And I don't know, there's something about that I just thought the way it was shot was really imaginative, and it was just really captured something about what was happening. I wondered what your favourite moments are, or the favourite scenes from the film so far that you've made.
Well, there are quite a few, and with these small modern cameras, the GoPro, which you can attach to the handlebars or to the helmet, there's so many great scenes where you know you feel you're part of the film. I think there's a very emotional scene where Lisa competes in her first championship and fails to get the bronze medal by 1/10 of a second. But nevertheless, the team at the dinner afterwards give her the official club shirt, you know, even though you really need to win a major prize. But she put so much effort into it. And that always chokes me up, even if I see it, you know, about 10 times. There's a fantastic guy who's 88 years old, and he's nicknamed the Cadet. And he really is just like a kid, you know, and he cycles practically every day of the week. And we've got a 5-minute clip on him coming out. And then there's two twins who ride BMXs. One of them has cerebral palsy and the other one doesn't. And to see the reaction between the two brothers and the competition between them is fascinating. So there are lots of moments that I love, you know, and in a way, I love to go on filming for ages, but we have to draw a line sometime, and hopefully I'll go back and share a few beers with everybody in the club for years to come.
That was Richard Galvani from Black Train Films talking to Culture's producer, Katie Bilboa. And you can see clips of their documentary and much more at imparablesdocumental.com. Still to come in part two, more from Helena Giselle's Midori House session and the lowdown on the Rockaway Beach Sandcastle competition in New York. Do stay tuned. Now a little more from that Midori House session from Helena Giselle. This is The Sun Is Rising.
Now the sun is rising, I can see what I've missed. Oh, come kiss me over and over. Show me what you've been missing too. Take me in your arms again. The dark night's over. I'm leaving my past behind. I'm breathing in something new. I'll break every chain that tied me down. That's what I'm gonna do. Waving that ghost goodbye. I'm looking for bluer skies. I know you'll be there at the end of the night. Now the sun is rising, giving heat to my lips, kissing me over and over. Why did you hide away so long? Now the sun is rising, all I can what I missed. So come kiss me over and over and over. Show me what you've been missing too. Take me in your arms again. The dark night's over. Ooh, I can't give you anything but love under the sun. Ooh. Now the sun is rising, giving heat to my lips, kissing me over and over. Why did you hide away so long? And now the sun is rising and I can see what I missed. Oh, kiss me over and over and over. Show me what you've been missing too. Now the sun is rising, I can see what I missed. So come kiss me over and over and over. Show me what you've been missing too. Now the sun is rising.
There you go.
That was Sun is Rising by Helena Giselle. And after her session, Helena sat down with Monocle's Paul Noble for a wee chat.
Helena Giselle, we are now in the studio after a rousing lunchtime performance. That was fantastic.
Thank you. It's pretty good. Felt good. Yeah.
Do you like playing in small places? Because you've done a lot of jazz clubs and small venues.
It's a bit of a cliche, but they are more intimate, I guess. So it's nice to be able to see the audience. And I like the stripped down band. I like that kind of acoustic feel. So, yeah.
So today you were joined by Paul on guitar. Usually you've got a slightly bigger band.
Yeah, this is only the second or third time I've worked with him. He's a great guitarist. But usually for gigs around town, I have a bass player as well and percussionist and yeah, guitar. So it's kind of quite a small outfit, if you like, but I like it.
So tell us a bit about the sound of the album, because obviously it's a much fuller...
Yes.
a much fuller sound,
Yeah, it's quite hard to get, I was saying to you earlier, it's quite hard to get that lush instrumentation with such a small band, which is where the percussion comes in, obviously, for live gigs. But the album itself, it's very filmic, is how I describe it. It's very, you can imagine it being in a Tarantino movie, or it's got a kind of, I think, a cult appeal to it.
This is a clear ploy to get on some soundtracks, isn't it?
No, I don't know what you're
talking about. Big horns all over it.
Yeah, and people do say when they listen to some of the tracks, there's a real Bond element in there as well. So all the things that I like, all those movies. And so that's how I describe it thus far.
It is definitely filmic. And there's also a big, you know, retro. There's echoes of Dusty Springfield. There's Eartha Kitt. There's all sorts of big soul belters there. Is this what you grew up listening to? Is this a recent
thing? I wouldn't describe myself as a soul belter. Oh, no. I did grow up when I was about... Growing up in Dublin, I was a slightly eccentric child in that I always wanted to listen to... Ella Fitzgerald was my first love, musically. Still is, for sure. I listen to her a lot. And Julie London, those quite sultry singers. I like all of that. All the Rat Pack things as well. But I did listen to contemporary music. I just was... You could say a bit stuck in an era.
So paint a picture for us. You were there in Dublin.
Yes.
You were 16 years old. What were you listening to? What contemporary stuff was tickling your ears at the time?
I was still listening to jazz and soul as well. I mean, really a lot. There was the Britpop, which I was mildly into as well.
Right.
I was also into, which was a long time before I was a teenager, but the trip hop. I was really into Portishead and Massive Attack. I actually got into them a lot later when... You know, after they'd come out, but because I think one of my elder sisters had a Portishead tape, like a cassette. Yep. If you remember those,
I do remember cassettes.
So I stole that, and actually, I think the reason being was that both of those bands had jazz musicians playing, so they must have had those elements of what I was into. So,
and so, talk us through a bit about the making of this album, because you recorded this in New York, I understand.
Yes, it is a tale of two cities, Paul. Half of it was written and recorded in Brooklyn, New York, with Truth and Soul. And the other half in London, Tan, with Paul O'Duffy. So, yeah, quite an odd mix, but it kind of works.
Now, Paul O'Duffy, for those who don't know, is a legendary songwriter and producer who's, I mean, he goes way back.
Oh, yeah. He knows his stuff, I tell you.
He knows his stuff, and he's recorded with all sorts of people. He's had, you know, some
Winehouse.
Big, yeah, Winehouse. Swing Out Sister.
Yeah. It was amazing working with him. I worked with Truth and Soul first. I just sent them some stuff and they really were really into it. So I found myself on a plane to New York to write with them, which was incredible. I think that's one of the most exciting moments. Apart from this, talking to you, which is probably the second most exciting moment.
So just getting back, you mentioned Amy Winehouse there.
Yeah.
Obviously, you know, a British soul singer is going to be always, you know, Amy Winehouse, Back to Black blew up. And then suddenly there was a whole... rash of Adele and Duffy and you know, a lot of people have come in her wake. Now, it's unfair that everyone's compared, you know, everyone's doing their own thing. Do you find this is something which happens to you? People mention Amy Winehouse?
It's going to be, because it's a similar genre, they're always going to be, and she did a lot of good. Amy Winehouse and Adele have done a lot of good for female soul singers and jazz singers. And in fact, I think Amy Winehouse did a similar thing to me, as in she was on the jazz scene for quite a while doing... The Great American Songbook, but people do. It's never far away. It's always a couple of sentences around when people are speaking to me, Amy Winehouse or Adele. So you know, they're not bad comparisons, but I think of myself as being very different.
So a few years down the line, are you picturing yourself in front of a big orchestra, swinging out, or are you seeing yourself in more of a rock venue with a band playing behind you?
I have no idea. A bit of both would be nice. Variety is the spice of life, Paul.
That was Helena Giselle talking to Paul Noble, who stepped in to assist here on The Culture Show. To New York next, where a lot of creative types have got sand in the hinges of their Ray-Bans, I expect. Can you imagine anything worse?
Inspirational mayors, money-making gentrifiers, park creators, subway planners, tech hub upstarts, wayfinding geniuses, broom-toting road sweepers, stadium designers, all-seeing historians, and squawking birds. The If they help make a city, you'll meet them on The Urbanist, Monocle's weekly show about the cities we live in that's presented by me, Andrew Tuck.
That's The Urbanist, premiering every Thursday at 1900 hours UK time, right here on Monocle 24.
Rockaway Beach in New York City was the scene of an unusual battle this month when more than a dozen artists participated in a sandcastle competition. Hosted by the public arts organisation Creative Time, the contest encouraged loose interpretations of the assignment during an afternoon of fun in New York's most up-and-coming waterfront. Monocle's Pauline Eiferman went along to soak up some rays and see what sandy offerings New York's creative community had carved up.
It takes a little more than an hour to get to the Rockaways from downtown Manhattan, yet it feels like a different world. The sand is white, and the crisp water moves to the rhythm of a light breeze. But today is not all about relaxing and sunbathing. A serious competition is underway, one that will determine which participating artists can build the best sandcastle. The countdown has begun. Painters, sculptors, filmmakers, and performers in swimsuits move frantically, shouting orders and grabbing tools. This is no laughing matter. They have less than 3 hours to complete their masterpiece.
People are digging furiously. Calories are being burnt. There is architecture. I didn't realize everyone would bring stuff. There's a lot of metal being put into the earth, plywood. There's this strange tripod here surrounded by some kind of corrugated metal that's just kind of sitting there enigmatically. The architects here, I saw a lot of rulers. I saw levels. So whatever it is, it's got to be precise. And then others are going straight up. I saw some sort of mermaid thing being built, which I'm quite excited about. Because I got a feeling the figurative will be very rare.
This is Nato Thompson, chief curator at Creative Time, the public arts organization behind the competition. Wearing only a pair of red swim shorts and a streak of sunscreen on his nose, he walks among the square plots of sand defined by ropes, screaming encouraging words into a megaphone. The members of Snarkitecture, the Art Architecture Collective, have been allotted the plot of land that sits right in front of the Creative Time tent. While the judges sunbathe, the group of artists is very much at work on what they call a daylight installation.
It'll look from the outside just like a big pile of sand. But from one or two sides, you'll be able to see the sun coming through, hopefully.
Have you been building sandcastles for a long time?
This is my first full scale.
I come from a long family of sandcastle builders, dating back to the 12th century Bavarians, so it's in my blood.
Whether they are amateur or professional sandcastle makers, there is only one rule that the artists have to adhere to.
The sandcastles have to be 75% made out of sand and only 25% other elements, but beyond that we encourage the artists to be really creative and to have fun, and so a lot of them are incorporating performances and costumes. There's woodworking and all kinds of things. Some people, I think, are even going to incorporate other humans into the sandcastle. We just had some guy who had raw sheet metal that they're using, and he cut his foot really badly and was soaking it in a bucket of blood. And then after he bandaged it up, he like threw the bucket of blood into the sandcastle. So we've got blood and guts and everything.
Alyssa Nitchin is Creative Time's head of development. She's the one who instigated this inaugural competition. It didn't take much convincing to get the crowd of art and party enthusiasts down to the far end of Queens. According to Assemblyman Philip Goldfeder, who represents Far Rockaways, the area is going through big changes.
There's always been people who lived here who enjoyed the beach, but there's this whole new artist, surfer movement that is taking place that is really moving from Williamsburg. Williamsburg in Brooklyn was the home of the hipster. And Rockaway is, it's not it yet, but it is slowly becoming a place where everybody comes to escape the city and be who they want to be.
Creative Time invited some of the most original emerging talents living in New York. Kenya Robinson, a young artist whose projects include roaming New York City to sleep over in people's homes, brought her unique take on the assignment.
The situation is that I didn't want to build a sandcastle. I've built so many in my life. I want to do something different. I want to go back even deeper to my roots and dig a hole.
Working with a team of fellow artists, she reveals her secret weapon.
You know what this is? This is Elmer's glue and water. If you don't know about this, you don't know nothing about no sand castles.
On another plot of sand, the Brooklyn-based duo Jennifer Gautron and Paul Outlaw share their own very specific techniques.
We are right now covering up our base armature with sand and packing it in as tight as we can so that we can actually make this support people on top of it. So we're going to have a performative aspect to our sandcastle. It's going to have people standing on top of these platforms, 12 feet tall in the end. We have plenty of time. That's probably enough time for us to all take a break and have a drink.
Is that cocktail hour? Is that what
cocktail
that
hour.
Did you plan this all before or is it improvised?
We have been training for 5 years with our crew of Olympians here in our USA swimsuits. And we have on a strict regimen of diet and liquor and steaks. And this is all paid off today for this main event of epic proportions.
Do you think you're going to win?
Absolutely. We wouldn't be here otherwise. That is the only reason we showed up.
The duo's creation turns out to be an intricate human and sand fountain, incorporating the costumed artists spitting water from jugs and straws. An impressive effort which wins the first prize. But judging from the crowd's enthusiasm, it seems very likely that a fierce rematch will be on next year. For Monocle, in the Rockaways, I'm Pauline Eiferman.
So that's just about all we have time for this week. You've been listening to Culture with me, Robert Bound. My producer was Katie Bilboa, and the show was carefully crafted together by the fast-fingered fondler, Holly Fisher. Time for one final song this week from her Midori House session. This is Helena Giselle performing Angel Save Me. Thanks for tuning in.
Wake me, my baby. I'm coming up for air. Sense your magic there. Sing my siren song, drowning for too long. Wish I could walk in truth, so you feel me like I see you. Try and breathe you in, carried by your wings, kicking up a fight, attracted to the light. Technicolor world so free. Now I see you like you feel me. Calling, I'm falling. Oh, my angel, save me from this tail that weighs me down, down. So heavy, it really breaks me. Rock me so gently, oh my angel, grant me gifts of grace and sleeplessness. So wake me, my little baby. You cut me like a knife from another life. Intoxicate my soul, such bliss to lose control. Flying closer to the sun, let it burn me like I love you. Calling, I'm falling. Oh, my angel, save me from this tail that weighs me down. So heavy.